lunch, so it keeps us happy.
For program development, here at the Chemical Heritage Foundation, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to the spring 2001 Early Bird Talk. I don't know where that name came from, but I guess it's good. Today, our speaker is James Fisher, the remaining son of Chester Fisher, the founder of Fisher Scientific, and the collector of the wonderful painting, the Brain, and the Pasteur artifacts and memorabilia that are known as the Fisher Collection here at the Chemical Heritage Foundation. Jim Fisher was associated with Fisher Scientific for approximately 40 years. Fisher Scientific internationally generously donated this amazing collection, and Jim was instrumental in arranging the gift, for which we are very grateful. He will now provide us with background on the company, on his father, the collector, and make comments on selected works in the collection. I am anxious to hear his presentation, as I know you are. Thus, please join me in welcoming Jim Fisher.
Thank you, John. Thank you very much. I have a knee which is a little bothersome on standing, and I will be at the reception later, and that will be standing, so I didn't want to do both. So I apologize for sitting down. It's just simply a matter of necessity. I also apologize for having scheduled this call last fall, this talk, and a minor medical problem intervened, and it had to be postponed, and in a few minutes you may wish it hadn't been rescheduled. I will allow, I swear to John, some time at the end for questions, and I will quit on time, and I will be at the reception, and that's my word. A couple words of acknowledgement. The staff here has been superb in taking this collection and reconditioning it and hanging it and building a wonderful gallery for you all to see it. And it's named for my late father. And if you have not seen it, I hope you will either following this talk or the reception or both, or if not, at another time, because it is a wonderful collection and very interesting. And the second wonderful acknowledgement goes to the company with which I no longer have any attachment, any affiliation. And Paul Montrone, the chairman of the board, with whom I became very friendly in, how shall we put it, negotiating the gift that came here, and in addition to making that magnificent gift on the part of the company, that he also made a sizable, or had the company make a sizable cash donation to help us mount it and stage it. Arnold Thackeray, your boss here, has asked me to talk briefly about the history of the company because it spans the century. It was started in 1902, and although it's no longer a family company, it spans only two generations, because Chester founded it as a very young man, and I'm 81, so we span an awful lot of time. And that's rather unusual, because a 100-year-old company, it will be 100 years next year, is usually third generation, if indeed it survives at all. So it really is a look at science in America, and to some degree the world, because the laboratory business so closely parallels the growth of technology and science. My dad was keeping things nice and symmetrical, was the class of 00 at the University of Pittsburgh, and was 20 when he graduated, and founded the company a year later. He was a mechanical engineer by graduation, and he had no mechanical ability at all. He couldn't drive a nail. He had trouble with his shoelaces. He really was not mechanical at all. However, in deference to that, I should mention that he fathered four children, all boys, and exactly 4 years apart to within 30 days. Now, the women in the audience will get that significance immediately, and the men can figure it out on the way home. One died in infancy. All three finally ended up at one time or another in the company. In 01, he was under the porch and heard a bunch of business friends of his father talking about, and they were all in the industry. Pittsburgh was an enormous center of industry. The problem of getting laboratory supplies and equipment. There was a source in Chicago. There was Eimer and Amann, two good German names, in New York. There was Arthur H. Thomas here in Philadelphia, and a few others. Problem, it took 2-3 weeks. The Pittsburgh Testing Laboratories, then local, now international, commercial testing laboratory, the referee test to which you sent samples to make sure your own lab was honest and correct, said, boy, it's a pain in the neck because they borrow stuff from me. They're my customers. So I got to lend them a case of test tubes until their shipment comes in. Then I had to keep track of who owes me what. And said the man, I just wish somebody would have a supply house here in Pittsburgh. Bingo. So, in 2002, he starts the company. He wasn't of age. He couldn't incorporate. He had to be 21 in Pennsylvania and most states at that time. Borrowed a few $1,000, opened with two employees, and the company was born. When he and mother were first married, and they moved in several walk-up flats, Mrs. Fisher would say, my mother would say, Margaret would say, Mrs. Jones, what does your husband do? Oh, he's a dentist, or he's a banker or something. How about you, Mrs. Fisher? He's in laboratory supplies. Of course, everybody heard it as laboratory supplies and couldn't wait to be invited to take a look at the bathroom to see if there was something very special. Everything was imported. There was no industry to make all the stuff that goes into laboratories. It was all from Europe. Everything was imported. And the major importer was a firm in New York that had been established in 1851 with those two good German names, Eimer und Amund. And they had, because they started out by speaking the language, agents all over Europe. And by George, you had to go through them to get a lot of the porcelain and glassware and chemicals and every other thing that a lab would need. And they gave my dad a very meager little discount. And he didn't have the agents established, but he got along and he made it. Quietly, he resented what Eimer und Amund was doing to him. And he was not a vengeful man, but in 1940, he had the quiet revenge of buying that company. Edison was a very good customer of Eimer und Amund, Thomas Edison, and he was a cut-and-try non-scientist. His idea was to try everything. You remember there were 700 or 800 things he tried to make the light bulb. He never did make a very good light bulb. The carbonized bamboo filament was very fragile. And Eimer und Amund made the pump that pumped out the air to make the evacuated tube into which the filament glowed. And it glowed. So Eimer und Amund, as they say in baseball, excuse me, Edison, as they say in baseball, got credit for the win. By the way, he was bought almost everything because it was a cut and try, and he never paid his bills. And when we bought Eimer und Amund, I went through the old books, and Edison owed us hundreds and hundreds of dollars and never paid us. And we never could collect it because when we went to talk to him in New Jersey, he hid in the closet under the bench. He's a crafty old guy. World War I cut off the European supply completely. As Dad said, the Kaiser turned the valve, and there was nothing coming in. And therefore, an industry was born in America to make the equipment, supplies, chemicals, glassware, instruments that you need in a laboratory. And it was born. And Corning made the glass. They were making something else. And Bausch and Lomb were making binoculars. They switched to microscopes, and so on it goes. So all of the stuff that goes in that was somehow filled in by the ingenuity of American industry, aided by the Kaiser. The old-timers said, wait, you wait until the war is over, we will all go back. But they didn't, because the industry was not only making a substitute, but making things as good or better. And about 1920, Dad began to collect. He began to collect alchemical and historical pictures. It was a personal interest, and he owned the collection himself for decades. He thought that the laboratory scientist was not given enough recognition. And this was a way to show the heritage and to honor the people in the laboratories, the men sort of behind the scenes who make so many other things possible. And this was a way to help them. And he published a little publication which he wrote himself for 20 or 25 years. And when I went with the company after World War II, I wrote it for 10 years. And it had a general interest article and an alchemical picture on the front cover. It was looked very non-commercial, but it was commercial to the teeth. And in behind the lead article, which was of general interest, there were a list of, guess what, new products. And it was very successful. In fact, it was so successful that many people, when we discontinued it, protested and said they hadn't been billed for their circulation and they'd let it lapse. And please renew their circulation. Now, that's the definition of a completely successful external house organ. The company grew, and the lab world grew, and people began to take recognition of what, indeed, laboratories meant. In about 1937, a an eminent British chemist named Sir William Pope, who had collected a wonderful collection of alchemical and historical pictures dealing with the history of science, died. And his estate came up for auction. And Dad had the amazing sense through an agent to bid. And he bid just right. And he bought the collection. In 1939, the war broke out. And the telegram came in from the agent who was packing up this priceless collection, which would double Dad's collection. Should I ship? Of course, the German submarines were all in the North Atlantic, and ships were being sunk in a woeful manner. And Dad had the sense to say, ship it. And they shipped it, and the ship was torpedoed and survived and limped back to port. They repaired the ship in another telegram. Now what should I do? And Dad had the sense to know that if the British scientific public ever woke up to the fact that this perfectly marvelous collection was being taken, guess what? By the Yankees again, he would never get it out of Britain. And he said, ship it. And it made the trip. And it is a significant part of the collection, a lot of which is on view at the Fisher Gallery, which if you haven't seen, you certainly should. You'll enjoy it. During the war, laboratories certainly came into their own, and we all know about the things that they made. In Fisher Scientific Company, I was not with the company at that time, we had an Army officer in the offices of the headquarters of the company, watching every incoming shipment notice from our suppliers and our own factories. And he had a great big stamp that said AAA-1, and that meant the priority went to where the Army officer said it went. And he would walk over and go, bang. I visited there once during the war. And there he was in uniform, and he would bang that stamp, and that meant that those balances that people had been waiting for went to where he said. And guess where a lot of it went? To a place called Oak Ridge, Tennessee. And it went down there by the carload. And the people in the trade called it the bubble gum factory, because the astonishing thing about Oak Ridge was, to us and to many other suppliers, was that everything went in and nothing ever came out. So why not bubble gum? Of course, what went out weighed about a pound. It went out at night, and it went to Los Alamos, and the rest is history, because that's what they were doing there. Finally, after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the then President Truman announced about the bombing and about the surrender of Japan, and I quote, "We have won," meaning the United States, "we have won the battle of the laboratories as we have won all the other battles." Now, the truth is, America did not win all the battles, although they certainly won the war. But the word was headline news. And to those of us in this kind of business, to have that kind of publicity and recognition for what laboratorians, as that word Dad coined, meant a lot, because all of a sudden people didn't confuse it with laboratory. I joined the firm after the war. One of the standard training procedures for my two older brothers was to write a catalog. I managed to skirt that somehow. That's a heck of a job. By devising, and not too long after I went with the company, a two-year catalog instead of the old 10-year cycle. The 10-year cycle meant you had to start to write all over the catalog. It's alphabetical, and by the time you got to B, something in A had changed, which is a form of insanity. And so I said, let's put out a two-year catalog and make it condensed, and we will knock the socks off competition. And boy, we did, because the little guy couldn't possibly do it. And we bought 15 or 20 of the small companies over many, many years. This business is bizarre. It's a strange business. Dad always called it the man behind the gun. In World War I, for example, there was a field gun, a 75-millimeter, that's 3-inch field gun made in America. And the War Department, which we now call the Department of Defense, put a full-page ad in many newspapers and said to people all over the United States, who can make a little gun sight to put on top of the gun so we can shoot this gun if we ever get it to France? Dad had about 12 people in the manufacturing shop. He tore out the ad and he went down to the Mellon Bank, a very large bank, and there sitting in the middle of the room, Andrew Mellon, later Secretary of the Treasury under three presidents and a genius, was sitting at a desk in the middle of the floor with a chair beside him. And he knew my grandfather slightly. Chester, how are you? Sit down. How's your father? Well, thank you. What can I do for you? I see this ad. He looked at the ad. Flags were flying. Irving Berlin was writing the over there, over there. There were stars in the window if you had a son. And it was patriotic. And Andrew Mellon looked at Dad and he said, Chester, I have only one question. Can you do it? Chester was about 38 years of age. Yes, Mr. Mellon, I can. Mr. Mellon reached into his vests. Everybody wore a vest those days. Pulled out his business card, wrote the $10,000 on the back that he wanted to borrow, and said, Chester, you take that over to the window, where there was a man with a green eye shade, of course, and they'll give you the money. He walked over, pushed the card under the window. The man with the sleeve garters and the eye shade gave him a receipt, and thus we had the money to buy the machines, to make the gun sight. It was the only gun made in America that saw action in World War I. When the Germans released poison gas, General Black Jack Pershing, in charge of all the Allied forces, burned up the wires. What were they to do? What kind of gas were they releasing? Because if you don't know the gas, you don't know how to make the gas mask. Was it mustard gas? Was it chlorine? Was it whatever? And Dad had a few people making gas analysis equipment. He had them and others work around the clock to make the gas apparatus that would analyze them. Built crates, which later could become a laboratory bench by turning them upside down. Put urgent War Department and a lot of other flirty stuff, which he made up, all over the crates. Dispatched two men who had never been out of Pittsburgh in their life to ride with the crates in the train and in the ship. And they set up the analysis in France, analyzed the gas, and they knew what to put in the gas masks. Talk about man behind the gun. This is a fascinating and strange business, and I'll give you just a couple of tiny examples. When I was just joined the firm after the war, I went out to the School of Dentistry with a local representative and met Dr. Jerry Cox, the dentistry school of part of the medical complex of the University of Pittsburgh. And Jerry Cox was working with the fact that he had been sent by Aluminum Company of America to go to Texas and find out why the cattle around an aluminum plant had wonderfully strong teeth, as cattle often do, but they were mottled. They had little black marks in them. He found out that the cattle had been eating the shrubbery and grass and everything else around the aluminum plant, and they used cryolite, sodium aluminum chloride, to melt the aluminum. You need it for the aluminum process. And they ate up too much fluoride, and their teeth were mottled, but boy, were they strong. Dr. Cox said, ha, ha. If we put small amounts of fluoride in the drinking water, we can practically cure caries, fissures, holes in kids' teeth down the years. Today, 75% of the drinking water in America has the proper amount of fluoride in it. Not too much, because they get mottled. But dental caries have declined to the point where dentists are going into cosmetic work, as you'll notice, and kids' teeth are infinitely better. Just one aspect. I sat on a stool at the University of Pittsburgh Medical School, and a young man named Jonas Salk told me that he had it licked. There wasn't any question. The University of Wisconsin, paid by the FDA, was testing his vaccine, and it would be announced very soon. But he said to me, there's no question about it. Our vaccine works. Polio is licked. A year later, it was announced, and Salk became a national hero. He was a lovely young man, liked him very much. When that happened, he got a little bit big for his hat. On the other hand, he was a brilliant man. In New Jersey, a salesman took me to the Bell Labs when Ma Bell was the phone company. And I went to the research labs and sat on a bench and talked to Dr. Bill Shockley. And he had big jars with hot salt solution all over them. Guess what make they were, I was pleased to say. They were being stirred. And I said, what are you doing? He said, we're growing crystals. I said, it's very interesting. Saturated salt solutions. And he said, I found that some of these crystals, when you take them out and dry them and put them between two pieces of metal, they'll pass current in one direction and not the other. Oh, I said, having been a radio ham in my youth, that's a halfway rectifier. Exactly, he said, astounded that anybody in the sales department could make a comment like that. And I said, furthermore, if you make a triple savage, maybe you can put another piece in between. You'll have what amounts to a triode, because like a grid in a triode tube, which the British call a valve. and you could take the place of a vacuum tube. He said, we've already done it. And of course, it was the transistor. Such is the kind of things you get into in this screwy business. Today, I think we take for granted the fact that laboratories are such an important part of our lives. I made a tiny little list on the plane. Our health, our safety, our science, our education, our crime detection, our metals, our plastic, our building materials, our medicines, our water and sewage treatment, our air quality, everything is touched by the laboratory. So, the old man had a heck of an idea. I'm going to say a few words about Pasteur. We have in part of the collection Louis Pasteur, who was a chemist and not a physician, although he is widely known as a physician. And it's part of the collection, but space does not permit showing much of it, except one notable item I'll mention. He was the founder of the science of bacteriology, which did not exist, and it was not created by a physician, but by a chemist, appropriate for the room and building we're in. His work on optical isomers, we have in the collection, not visible, are wonderful pictures of the optical stereopic pictures of tartaric acid, both levulo and dextro, which you will see. He saved, he of course, a Frenchman to his fingernails. He saved the silk industry because the silkworms in southern France ate mulberry leaves. And by George, the mulberry trees got a disease. And he found out the microorganism that caused it and cured that microorganism. And the mulberry trees flourished and the silkworms flourished and the silk industry was saved. But what really made him a hero with France was the fact the winemakers discovered that their wonderful fermentation process was producing vinegar. It was damn good vinegar, but it wasn't wine. And he found out that by sterilizing the containers and using the right microorganism, you could produce, guess what, wine. And if you want to be a hero in France, that's the way to do it. And there's a memorial in every street in southern France has a fountain or an avenue or a boulevard named after Pasteur. Pasteur never was one very much to give credit to others. He did acknowledge the work of Edward Jenner, you know, who remember conquered cowpox and smallpox in England, and Lister, Lord Lister, the surgeon, who sprayed carbolic acid in his operating rooms to the tremendous irritation of the throats of everybody involved, but the wounds he was working on did not become subject to infection. Now, the interesting thing about those guys and others was that they knew what they were doing, but they didn't know why. They really didn't know why the infection, why these things happened to wine and other things. By, in effect, creating the science of bacteriology, Pasteur explained why these things happened. And the rest, as they say, is history. In 1935, my mother and dad took my middle brother, Ben, who was 4 years older than I was 15. We went to France and to Paris for the usual. We waited an hour and a half to get into Napoleon's tomb. The line was so far. Here was a tyrant whose work had killed hundreds of thousands of troops. When we got in a taxi, we asked to go to the Pasteur Institute on the Rue Docteur on the left bank. A little trouble finding it. Got there, shook the gate, rang the bell. A little old man came out, finally let us in. Some schoolboy French, which was fair then, much better now. He showed us through the labs. Pasteur died in 95. Everything is exactly as he left. His spectacles are on the desk. It's spooky. Every test tube is sealed off, and in it is the culture that was there when he died. It's fascinating. If he had walked back, there it would be. It's fascinating. And we then, having been shown around, we got in the taxi, and Dad's giving me some coins, and he said, Jamie, thank the man and give him this. So I did. Brother Ben and Dad got in a taxi, and I thanked the little man and asked him what his name was, and he told me. I got in the taxi, and as we drove off, Dad said, what did he say his name was? I said, he said his name was Joseph Meister. There was a dead silence. And Dad said to me, that was the rabid boy who at age 14 had been brought to Pasteur, doomed to die of rabies. Pasteur, who was not a physician, had tested his vaccine on animals but never on humans, was not allowed to do so. If the boy died, he undoubtedly would have been imprisoned, maybe guillotined. And that was the boy who never left. He stayed as a helper, janitor, cleaner-upper. In 1939, France capitulated, and the Germans occupied France, and two German officers went to the Pasteur Institute because they were interested. They spoke some French. They rang and banged the door. This same little old man came down with a cane and looked at the officers. They demanded entrance. He denied them. One officer pulled a gun, pistol. The old man shook his head and in a wink pulled his own pistol out from under his smock, shot himself in the head, and lay dead across the gate. He's buried in the garden. The Alchemist is a subject of the talk, and you wondered when in the world I would ever get around to it. It's lots of fun, and you'll see a lot of alchemical pictures in the collection, and a few we're going to show you on the screen, only to sort of help you know what to look for. He was kind of the village idiot. He was a strange, oddball guy. You must remember that paintings painted religious paintings for 500 years, and they adorned all the churches and cathedrals of Europe, and they're magnificent. And royalty, you've had the king and the queen and the prince were all painted. But scenes of the ordinary village people, so-called genre paintings, are sort of new, and they came in perhaps around 1450, 1500. So here was a village scene with a very interesting oddball character who worked in the cellar and did strange things and made odd smells, and you could peek at him through a window and see what he was going on, although you really didn't know what he was doing down there. So he was the topic of a lot of very interesting drawings and etchings and paintings, and a number of Flemish, some German, a few Northern Italian, and almost no French, no British people painted him. And a lot of our work are Flemish, the present Netherlands and Belgium, of course. What in the world does it mean? Alchem comes from the Arabic word. It means dark soil for some reason, and the word alchem came out of that. And chemistry came out of that word. There are little tiny symbols of ancient China and Egypt dabbling in that sort of thing. What were these odd ducks trying to do? One, they were trying to turn base metal into gold. So they were backed privately or not so privately by royalty, because royalty meant you could buy troops, because troops were almost totally mercenaries. When George Washington crossed the Delaware, he attacked the Hessians, not the British. So that for centuries, troops were mercenaries. Money meant troops. So the rich boys, the royalty, backed the alchemist and said, in effect, you find the secret, Buster, remember it's mine. You sign the patents to me, if you want to use modern terms. The second thing they were trying to do, and by the way, at some 20 years ago, at some place in a cyclotron, some physicist was able to bombard the nuclei of gold and turn it back into lead. The second thing they're trying to do is find the elixir of life, the pill of immortality. Who isn't looking for that until you get to be kind of arthritic? But anyway, that was the other thing they were looking for. And these guys might find it. So you find them all mixed together, working a lot with metals to try and transmute them into gold, and also doing all kinds of bizarre experiments because, gosh, it was thought that the secret to the elixir of life and the pill of immortality was somewhere in a book. But remember, before we make fun of alchemists, we must remember that out of the alchemists, 1550 to late 1600s, came chemistry, medicine, certain branches of dentistry, botany, zoology, metallurgy, and to some degree physics. They derive from the old crazy lab worker, the alchemist. By the time you got into around 1700, modern science of Dalton, Lavoisier, Priestley, Boyle, and there's a wonderful picture of Boyle in this building, had sort of modernized science. So it wasn't the cut and dry. Edison was cut and dry. The alchemist invented cut and dry. And So while we make fun of him, he is the sort of great-great-great-great-grand-granddaddy of all kinds of laboratory science. And now, Tim, if you will, let's hit the light here, and I'll turn on this projector. We'll whip through a few slides. That's Louis Pasteur. Dad worshipped him and built the Pasteur Memorial and collection about him. He's an extraordinary man. He was not so terribly modest, but he did acknowledge the men I did mention. But unlike Newton said when he was honored late in his life, Newton, probably the greatest scientist in 500 years, they say that I stand tall among men, but if it is so, it is because I stand on the shoulders of giants. That is Pasteur's laboratory in a caricature cartoon. This is some of his glassware, and a lot of it is around this building, collected by Dad. And that is Joseph Meister, the little old man that let us in 1935 and denied the Germans in 1940. There's the old boy, and you see him working at the lab. It's typical of many, many of the old-timers. The book, the alembic, all kinds of botanicals in the background, a distillation going on there behind him, because that was seen in many of these pictures, a distillation going on here in the front. What you and I call a mortar and pestle in the very, very front there, which is seen in pharmaceutical laboratories. It used to be seen in old-time pharmacies, but and the heavy velvet gown, because heck, no heat in those days. Now, an interesting story here. There's the alchemist doing a very commonly performed test, the urine test for pregnancy. And the serving woman is pulled up her skirt there. You can see that not only is she a serving woman and a cleaning woman, but she also is pregnant. And mom is dumping the chamber pot because the results are pretty clearly positive, as one can see by the... And Dad here is getting the chamber pot for his indiscretions. But you see the mixture of science. You see a skull, the guy was messing around with physiology, the globe, geology, and the music, the bass, the cello, and an anatomical drawing behind him. All kinds of science mixed together. The old boy there with a tear in the chair because this didn't pay very well, this profession. The fume hood, as we would call it today, the distillation apparatus up under the hood. It's called a search. And here he is looking at the books. Golly, maybe the answer is in the next book. If I stay at it, I might hit it. You never can tell. Again, a very popular test. And, of course, the alchemist had one eye on the flask and one eye on the abdomen of his client. You see a dentist in the background pulling a tooth because they were all mixed together. And the barber surgeon, which later, of course, evolved into the surgeon, was often seen in these old scenes. There's a distillation apparatus here at the right going on. She seems to have her hand up saying, oh, my gosh, oh, boy. Here's the old guy working. And it's more or less the same as distillation apparatus. He's an old-timer. He's pretty ragged, pretty tired. Here is an old crone. I mean, maybe she's a serving woman that came as a delivery, because it seems unlikely that she's the one that whose urine he's testing for pregnancy, because it just wouldn't seem to fit. But you look at the mess, and he's involved in everything. On the ceiling, you find in many of these pictures both a fish, preserved fish, the ancient Christian symbol, and a lizard, reptile, or one of those groups, because that is sort of the opposite of the Christian business. You played both sides, because if the powers that be were going to help you, it was sort of like betting on both horses in a two-horse race, because you don't know which power is going to empower you to solve the problem. So here you see both the fish at the ceiling, and these show up a lot better when you see the actual pictures, which I hope you will. And he is diagnosing her as obviously some sort of pregnancy. The old guy holding up the flask again, looking in the book, in the cellar. They're often below ground, and the usual fume hood to take away the fumes, which of course was convection. The heating source was not the famous Fisher burner, of course, but charcoal. This guy is dropping a scorpion into the mix. Why not? It might do the trick. And what have you got to lose? And there's a skull down here in the foreground. He's in a fume hood. Here's the old boy by the window. Now, this is a rather advanced sort of guy, but look at the mess. And there's a colloquium going on. They're still holding colloquiums all over the place. The scientists all over the place get together and talk each other to death. And that's what's going on here in the 1650s. Studying a book, maybe he can find the formula. This guy didn't calculate very correctly, and the safety of Marshall hadn't been around. He's working at home. How do we know? There's mom changing the baby in the background. The curtain has been pulled by the painter, so indeed you find it. Now, this painter, Heerschop, is a very famous Flemish painting. Some of these works are museum quality, absolutely beautiful museum quality. Some are just ordinary anonymous paintings. This guy's Heerschop, and he signed it in the book. When you see that painting, you will see that he signed it, a good Flemish name. Bang! There's a pewter tray in the front with a piece out of it. Who knows? Did he saw a piece out of that? Pewter, of course, is tin and lead mixed. Maybe that would be the base metal, which he could change to gold. Who knows? He miscalculated on that. This guy working by the window. Beautiful painting of the brass container there on the floor. A colloquium going on. No, I guess not. That's their assistants, laboratory assistants. They're probably graduate students. You get them for almost nothing. The skull, constant reminder of the time is limited. The beautiful tapestry, Turkish rug. Why not? In the old days, physicians and dentists hung their diplomas in the waiting room to impress you. Here, the tapestry, the Turkish rug on the table. So when you came in as a client, you were impressed. Because your clothes may be torn, the place is a mess, but you're impressed by the Turkish rug. This guy is mostly involved in anatomy. You see the magnificent painting of the human muscular structure. A dwarf in the foreground, puffing up the charcoal for the distillation that's going on. Assistants in the background with a fume hood. The light on the man's face is wonderful. It's a beautiful painting von Helmont. Again, a Flemish painter of about 1650-70. I'm not giving you a lot of painters' names because I'm just not going to remember them, but they are labeled, of course, in the Fisher Gallery. A rather dignified, older-timer guy with a red cap, beautiful. Notice the sword. Remember Damocles and the famous sword hanging by the thread. Don't get too uppity. The thread might break. So maybe as a reminder, this says, okay, old boy, you don't know everything. Remember the sword, and it could fall. The explosion again. This is rather big in those days because he's working in secret to see you. The curtain is pulled because this was secret stuff going on. And you didn't want to disclose too much. Wonderful painting of brass. This guy's preparing medicines of one kind or another, and you see natural herbs in the very foreground. Is endive, if you wish, from which it was supposed to have medicinal properties. And you took and made an elixir with alcohol, and you made medicine. So what this guy is really doing in the old days is making this little pharmaceutical company. This is Lilly and Dow and the Merck and Sharp and Doane and the whole schmear right here. Aha, guess what? The same old analysis with the same and a concerned client, patient, whatever. Notice the fine Turkish rug on the table. That's impressive. It ups your fee. The old boy, isn't he wonderful? 10 years, the great painter of alchemical pictures, working in the fume hood. The skull, he's below ground. You see the window and his buddies in the background. 10 years painted the alchemist, but he also had a sense of humor. So here he portrays the alchemist. In French, it says le plaisir des fous, the pleasure of those who are nuts, who are foolish. And he makes fun of the alchemist working away at his lab in the fume hood, but has the sense of humor saying they really were kind of, in a way, the object of ridicule. The discovery of phosphorus, because the old boys stumbled across probably 8 or 10 elements in the search for other things. It's called serendipity. You start to look for A and you find B. And here's the discovery of phosphorus from an engraving by Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T. A wonderful painting. This is a wonderful engraving that Dad picked up from an agent in Europe. The old alchemical symbols. And there's a symbol for vitriolic acid, which is sulfuric acid, and a symbol for arsenic, and a symbol for sodium chloride, and on and on and on, long before Dalton proposed the present system. The old boy, now we come to modern times, much more modern. It's just at the end of the alchemical picture. And you see, here he's working with a wooden clamp, a test tube. It's not a Fisher Scientific clamp, but it's wood, and it won't rust like Fisher Scientific clamps. Won't rust either, but anyway, his chair is torn and battered, but he has a certain elegance of velvet and maybe a little fur around the collar, a mess on the floor, but he's working with something quite modern. And is that it? Thank you. May I have the lights, Tim? Now, somebody want to say it as a wind-up. Excuse me that. I will take questions. Let me see. I think our time is just right. Do we have a few minutes for questions before we break up? I have lots of answers. I will be at the reception. You can quiz me. I want to just say in conclusion that this collection here in this institution is a real jewel. It's unique in Philadelphia. It's unique in the state. It's unique in the country. It's unique in the world. And I hope very much that you people here in Philadelphians will take very good care of it. You've been a wonderful audience. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
How many pieces are in the collection? Are they all here?
The whole collection is here. It can't possibly be exhibited. There are probably 200 frameable, hangable works of art, paintings, engravings, lithographs, photographs, everything. And then there are objects, laboratory objects of all kinds. There's an old balance, there are old microscopes, there are old glassware, ancient bottles, all kinds of stuff. They'll need a lot more room to exhibit all of it, and it will be rotated. You can see a very nice cross sampling in two places, in the Chester Fisher Memorial Gallery, and also in a small room at the end of the boardroom in this building that shows 6 or 8 pictures just acquired from a collector in California whose name?
Roy Edelman.
Apparently attracted by the Fisher collection, as my dad used to say, them as has, yits. And like the Metropolitan, you have a great collection, everybody wants to give stuff to the Metropolitan, they don't know what to do with it, but it's prestige. So anyway, one attracts the other. And there are some wonderful alchemical pictures that have just recently been arrived. They're in a small windowless room at the back of the boardroom. Yes, sir?
I'm sure know that Newton did spend more time on alchemy than he did on
Newton did indeed spend time on alchemy, and so did Boyle, who is credited with a great deal of modern chemistry, and if you remember your chem classes, and I'm sure you don't, Boyle's law of partial pressure and Boyle's law of gases, I remember it very well. But anyway, he dabbled in alchemy. I guess, why not? Maybe you'll hit something big. Maybe you'll hit penicillin. Fleming did. He took a vacation. The stuff was in the sink, and he came in Monday. Bingo! Penicillin was discovered. Totally by accident. Yes, sir? Thousands of prints. Dad was smart as all get out. He offered engravings, reproductions, good quality, with very modest company name on them, very modest, both black and whites and colors. Probably both sales and giveaway, the salesmen were given a quota they could place them, 25,000, and they still do at a very modest price, both framed and unframed, of the outstanding parts of the collection. What a stroke of genius. You hung this on the director of the laboratory's wall. He had pride in the alchemist, his heritage, his great-great-great-great-great predecessor. And when he moved, retired, or whatever, The new man moved into the head of the laboratory's office. Guess what? There was the picture. Nobody ever took it down. He drove our competition bananas. There's a question over here, sir. Yeah.
I just want to say about Newton, he applied what he learned in alchemy when he became director of the Royal Mint. He had to know how to analyze the gold to make sure it was proper purity.
He was smart in many ways. He stood on the shoulders of giants. I think that's the most extraordinary quotation that I know of. Any more? I beg your pardon? Father died in 84. He went from his desk to the hospital. Both my brothers are deceased. I'm the youngest and survivor. They were born in 8, 16, 8, 12, 16, and 20. One died as an infant. I was born in 20. So I am the last of them.